Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Nate Klarfeld in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and this is Stonewall Live, the best of gay and lesbian book, film, and media talk on Blog Talk Radio. Tonight I have Sean Strub with me. Sean's best known for being the editor, the founder, of Pause Magazine, but he has been an outspoken advocate for self-empowerment movement for people with HIV/AIDS. The list of things goes on and on, from running for Congress in 1990 to beginning the beginnings of mass marketing for LGBT fundraising. Sean, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to join you.
As a lot of listeners know, that I work with the Stonewall Library here in Fort Lauderdale, and I have in front of me the volume one, number one, and I'm going to read your first letter to the editor, letter to the reader. By the way, you have a really hot picture in here done by Andrew Eccles in 1994. Do you remember that picture?
You remember that picture.
You should use that, like, in all your things. You know, no one would know. Anyway, dear reader, there is no cure. Choose one. Which is it? Choose one of these. There is no cure. There won't be. AIDS has become cancerized. AIDS activists are dead, burned out, and bored. AIDS groups are marked by dissent and despair. Too much of the fight against AIDS is driven by greed, ego, and power. Or number two, people with AIDS are living longer and healthier lives. AIDS researchers work selflessly for long hours. AIDS activism has helped drive the campaign for reform of healthcare systems. Number three, a lot of both. That was a long time ago. What's changed?
Well, there's certainly nothing about those statements that's changed. One could say the same thing today. But, of course, there have been many obvious changes, most notably combination therapy that has enabled so many of us to still be here today.
Mm-hmm. And you're a 30-year AIDS survivor, and which is amazing. You look great on your pictures. Are those your new pictures?
You're right. Yeah. You know, the thing about pictures I discover is that no matter how bad they are when they're first taken, if you throw them in a drawer or file them away in a few years, they start to look better and better.
That's great. That's exactly right. All right, I'm going to start talking about AIDS activism because that's been your main focus, even though you've worked in a lot of other areas in activism, GLBT work. What's the difference? What do you see differently between AIDS activists today and 15, 17 years ago?
I think that the most important difference to me is that 17 years ago, when we started PAWS, or 20 years ago, or whenever, many of the activists were themselves trying to save their own lives. You know, they were on likelihood of dying from AIDS, and so it was a lot of the movement was very self-interested, and I put myself amongst that. You know, I was very interested in saving my own life and the lives of my closest friends. Today, I think the people who are still doing this work recognize that the AIDS epidemic is part and parcel of a whole broader range of social problems and social ills, and it's very difficult to attack it in isolation. You cannot cure AIDS or deal with the epidemic without also dealing with the drivers of the epidemic, including poverty and racism and homophobia and co-infections and addiction issues and mental health issues and all that related kind of thing. So I think we've become more sophisticated in our activism.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who are doing it, it's a much broader and more diverse group. One of the most heartening things to me is, the number of really young people who aren't positive and hopefully will never become positive. They're not necessarily gay, but they really see this as the kind of the nexus of the important progressive social change work that is underway right now, and we kind of pioneered that, and that's pretty cool.
It is very cool. Yeah, it is very cool. PAWS magazine, and there's other magazines, the Spanish magazine, the women's breast cancer magazine, the African American magazine. You're like the magazine maven here. But it's widely distributed in the gay and straight community. You can find it almost anywhere. And it's been a voice of reason and honesty. when the stigma of AIDS in the early 90s was you know, just outspoken fear, irrational behavior from anywhere, schoolyards, family dinners, the White House, news broadcasts, TV shows, your voice through the magazine. It really was your voice, and we'll talk later about the transitions. It was the signing beacon. It rarely does one man have that much effect on a movement, and I do call this a movement. I remember I really in the early when I was early, you know, in my early days of being infected, I like would wait for Pop Magazine coming this week or next week. Is this a 2-monther? Is this 1-monther? And it really was something, and I read it cover to cover because there was nothing else out there. Did you feel that when you were writing it?
I mean, of course, there were a lot of people writing it. It wasn't just me, but we did. I mean, you know, when PAWS launched, one of the reasons that I was so driven to create PAWS was that everywhere in the mainstream media, anytime the epidemic was referenced, it was inevitably fatal, dread disease, no cure, no survivors, 100% terminal. The possibility of survival had been taken away from those of us with HIV. And I really believe that there is a very important, you know, mind-body connection. When we say we have a feeling in the pit of our stomach, or we have cold feet, or the hair on the back of our neck rises, or whatever, those are physiological reactions to some kind of intellectual stimulus, whether it's fear or anger or hope or whatever. I think the immune system must work the same way. And when it's assaulted with the death sentence messages, it surely isn't going to respond as well. So while that's what the media was saying, in my own life, I was certainly surrounded, as so many of us were, with, you know, indescribable loss, but also with a phenomenal vitality of people who, yes, they were positive and they were struggling with that challenge, but they were falling in love and they were breaking up and they were getting promoted and getting fired and raising their children and leading these incredibly vital lives. So the idea with PAWS was to sort of reflect the lives of people with HIV and the whole range of those lives without having a party line. You know, in the first issues, it was very important for us to show people really diverse approaches to treatment and to all the issues involved. And I kind of rambled and forgot your question, but...
It's okay. No, you're right there. Yeah.
So that was really what was... So yes, the answer was when we were creating it, we knew we were creating something that people were not hearing in very many other places. And what you described about waiting for the magazine to arrive and sitting down and you know, reading it right away, cover to cover, you know, we always thought that was the greatest compliment. And there were, you know, especially those first couple of years, it really reinforced the idea that, you know, there was a lifeline here. And it's because it was people with HIV talking to each other. And that was, I always thought, was the sort of secret to the magazine. I never had a medical advisory board. You know, I respect expertise, but right. We always start with the first experts being people themselves who were positive, and then the scientists, the researchers, the doctors, everybody else, you know, sort of came in after that. We started with the voice of those of us who were experiencing this in our lives every day.
Right, that's true. Okay, I'm going to ask you some other questions here. First of all, I'm going to go ahead and tell you our connection, which we've never met till we started talking on the phone. In 2003, PAWS Magazine did an issue, a Valentine's Day issue called Looking for Love. And I was featured as one of the 53 most eligible bachelors and bachelorettes in the United States with HIV. I know that sounds pretty
I remember funny. That issue very well.
Yeah, well, listen, you know, we have the issue all over the house and the pictures and everything. Anyway, my partner, who is was a psychiatrist in Dallas, I was living in Fort Lauderdale, I'm just telling on him because I can. He was in his psychologist's office. Psychiatrists have to be psychoanalyzed every week. And so he was complaining that if there were no men over 50 to date that were like normal in Dallas. And so then on his way out, of course, he picks up a PAWS magazine, opens it up, and there I am. Emails me, and a few weeks later, he moved to Florida. And that was 8 years ago.
That's a fantastic story. I love hearing that.
Isn't that great? It's been great. It's been really great ever since. Isn't that funny?
But, you know,
go ahead.
When for years, we talked about at the PAWS.com site,
hello.
Are you there?
What happened?
Okay, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
we talked about the creating Paz Personals, and never did it until when I sold the magazine and the new owner Jeremy Grazel came in and created Paz Personals, and it's been such a monstrous success. They have over 100,000 Paz Personals now, and the reach magazine is phenomenal. I mean, my youngest sister Megan remains the publisher, and she tells me that their research shows that every month they reach about 3/4 of the people in the United States who know they have HIV, either read the magazine or visit the website.
Right. It seems like the website is, you know, that's the new one. Here we are in internet radio, and you know, I know that the Paz magazine is part of AIDSMeds.com, and I believe one other website. I'm not sure. I guess Paz Personals. That's the third one. And I guess some of the stuff. Go ahead.
That's fine. There's the blogs, there's the forums at AIDSMeds. I mean, there's so many different things. I mean, the website has really been wonderful to watch it you know, grow so much.
Right. So anyway, I just want to let you know, I surprised you with that one because I didn't want to let you know that beforehand. But I'm one of those, they featured us twice in the magazine since then on Valentine's Day edition about still being together. It's kind of funny. I think the last one was 2006.
You know, I remember that feature that you had met through that looking for love issue now, but I didn't connect that with your name until right now when you brought it up.
Well, that's okay. Well, you know, I just thought it was a coincidence. There are no accidents. Tell us about your relationship with Keith Haring, the artist.
Well, I knew Keith. We actually were the same age and moved to New York at the same time, almost within a matter of a couple of months of each other. We weren't close friends, but he was very generous and very supportive of my activism every single time. You know, I talk about sometimes about, you know, those days in the mid and late 80s and the early 90s, that there were a certain number of people who every single time they were asked to do anything for any of the different, you know, things I was involved with and a group of us, they always said yes. And Keith was one of those people. You know, when I was helping to launch National Coming Out Day in 1987, and asked Keith, he said he'd love to do a graphic for it. Well, they're still using that today, that image of somebody stepping out of the closet. I'll tell you how Keith Haring got involved in ACT UP. This is actually a great story. Pardon?
I want to know.
Okay, I don't think this has ever really been reported anywhere. I've written about it, but I haven't published it. I had a very dear friend in ACT UP named Sven Swenson, who was an older guy who was a Broadway dancer, and he would come to ACT UP every Monday night. And he had a dog, Fever, that he always called the gay dog. He had a T-shirt on it, and he'd use Fever to help raise funds. He'd shake a can at events and stuff. And Sven was moving to Los Angeles and had signed a contract to sell his he owned a townhouse in New York on Minetta Lane to sell it to Keith Haring. And then Keith came to him. Keith had been diagnosed and was quite sick when he was diagnosed, and came to Sven and said he really couldn't go through with the purchase, and would that be cool? And Sven, who was also positive, said yes, of course. They ended up becoming friends. So Sven would come to ACT UP meetings on Monday night, and after the meeting would go over to Keith's house, or Keith's studio, his loft, and spend the night with him while Keith painted. And Sven would just talk. Sven was like kind of an older guy, sort of a mentor in ways to Keith. But Sven could never get Keith to come to ACT UP. We knew that, you know, if Keith came to ACT UP, that'd be really hot and people would be talking about it, you know, because we had Charlie Sheen coming some and Susan Sarandon came few times and so on. And you know, ACT UP was just kind of like such a sexy thing at that time.
Right.
But when we were planning to stop the church action, which was the demonstration at St. Patrick's Cathedral, it was enormously controversial. And I think historically is really very important and a turning point in a number of ways, but that's another issue. I think it was Richard Deagle at ACT UP created a poster. We were going to St. Patrick's Cathedral specifically to protest Cardinal O'Connor and how their you know, engaged in politics in New York was damaging people with HIV and others and preventing safer sex education in schools and so on. So I'm pretty sure it was Richard who created this poster. And the poster was black and white photograph of Cardinal O'Connor, head and shoulders with his mitre, you know, the pointed hat that the cardinals wear, right?
Right.
On one side, and on the other side, about the same size, it was a picture of a used condom, flattened out. And across the top, the headline said, "Know your scumbags." Underneath the used condom, it said, "This one prevents AIDS."
Oh, no.
So, Richard Bridges' poster, we get him printed up, and we're, you know, having our fundraising committee. So Sven cracks up over the poster, as everyone did, takes a copy of it, one of them that night, to Keith's studio, and gives it to Keith, who says, "Okay, that's it. He's got to come see what this ACT UP thing is all about." And the next week, Keith came to ACT UP, and very shortly after that, he agreed to do a fundraising letter that I wrote and produced, and Keith actually... I was fronting the printing and the letter shop and that sort of thing, and the list work, the database work. Keith put up the money for the postage. Actually, he donated the money for the postage. Wow. And I think, if I remember right, and I hope I'm not telling a tale out of school, he brought it was about $15,000 or $20,000 in cash in a brown paper grocery bag to an ACT UP meeting to pay for the postage for the mailing.
In New York, right?
In New York, yeah. He didn't give that to me, and I may not have that part of the story exactly right, but I know that he paid for it. And I created a laser font in his handwriting. He read him right out every letter of the alphabet a couple of times, and we made a laser font, which was kind of innovative at the time. In fact, after Keith died, Julia Gruen at the foundation gave them the font because they continued to use it for, you know, sending out cards on. And so we did that fundraising letter from Keith, and he did a wonderful poster that was a, you know, if you gave $50 or something, we did the poster, and then we sold the posters. That's kind of a hear no evil, speak no evil, see no evil, you know, ACT UP, silence equals death. And then in the fall of 88, we did an auction. I'm sorry, it was in 89. We were doing an auction at, to raise money for ACT UP. And Keith donated what we called a totem. It was a sculptural piece. And when he donated it, he said, "Look, you know, this should probably bring, you know, $12,000 to $15,000. It's like a pretty cool thing. They just want to make sure we didn't let it go away for, you know, for too little." Mm-hmm. And then a few weeks before the auction, Julia or Margaret from the foundation called and said, "Look, you know, that's a limited edition thing, and they're kind of hot, and it might bring like $20,000 or $25,000, just sort of a heads up." And we were like really excited. Well, the night of the auction, when that piece came up, it very quickly went up $25,000, $35,000, $45,000, $50,000, and everybody, I think when it broke $50,000, everybody broke into a big, you know, cheer and chant.
Right.
And then it got up to about $60,000, and there were two bidders remaining, and they were serious art people who had come to this ACT UP fundraising auction to buy, you know, this and some other work that was there. And there were 300 people there, and the whole crowd started chanting, "ACT UP, fight back, fight AIDS, ACT UP, fight back, fight AIDS," while the bidding was going on. So these poor bidders were under this incredible pressure, this whole room, this incredibly exciting dynamic, and then it sold, I think, for $70,000 or $71,000.
Oh, wow.
And was pandemonium in that room. It was one of the most exciting moments of my life. I get goosebumps right now just thinking about it. And that that money paid for a lot of street theater and a lot of our actors. And Keith, you know, died just a few months later in February of 1990. He was a very cool guy.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure I asked you about that. I'd read some things about it. Nothing to do with what you've just told us. Do you think things like that are going to be happening again? It seems like everything with HIV and AIDS activism now is pretty sterile. I mean, you know, I mean, don't ask, don't tell. We had Lieutenant Choi chain himself to the White House. Nobody's done anything with HIV AIDS. Nobody's thrown blood or chained themselves to the FDA or thrown themselves at the Montana State House or any of those things that were pretty common in the late '80s, early '90s. Is that ever going to come back?
Well, we'll see. You know, of course, in Florida, you've had a particular problem with your state ADAP program, but it's all over the country. You know, thousands of people on waiting lists people who've been on ADAP and getting their treatment through that and then getting cut off, others who are in desperate need of treatment and not able to get it. I think that that is one issue that may bring people back into the streets. It is entirely possible that we will see people who have been stable and relatively healthy for years now starting to become sick because they lose access to their treatment, both in the U.S. and globally. And this is a huge, huge issue globally with, you know, millions of people on treatment, and that future of that treatment being supplied to them is in jeopardy. There's also, you know, big differences between today and years ago. For one thing, civil disobedience today, especially the kind of the creative stuff that ACT UP did, carries a greater risk. You know, being arrested in New York at a demonstration is not quite like it was a few years ago. The targets are, you know, so much more complex. It's one thing when, you know, you're trying to get a specific treatment approved that is in the pipeline, or you get something expedited or a rule passed or this or that. You know, when you're dealing with core, you know, root issues that impact the epidemic, that, you know, things as broad as, you know, healthcare and the other kinds of things, it's just much more difficult to get people to take those kinds of, you know, extreme actions. And arguably, it may not be as effective as it once was. Further, you know, we have a Democratic president, and I have always thought that not just with AIDS activism, but with GLBT activism, that we have been more effective when we are outsiders, when we have had Republican leadership in the White House.
Really?
When Bill Clinton was elected, you know, we were kind of co-opted. You know, the community worked so hard to get him elected. He was so much better than the alternative he got, you know, I don't want to say a free ride, but he wasn't given as hard a time as he might have been otherwise. And, of course, same with the Obama administration. And I'm a tremendous supporter of President Obama, and I'm actually not as disappointed with him as I think, you know, many of my friends and colleagues are. But the fact is, you know, having someone we work so hard to get elected, who we know is so sincere in what he wants to do for the country, and the depth of the seriousness of the problems he faces in so many fronts, it's kind of tough to get as angry in as narrow a way.
Right.
But, you know, will it come back? You know, it's coming in different issues. You know, there are certain things, you know, HIV criminalization, I think people are increasingly becoming aware of and becoming concerned about it and understanding why it is so incredibly serious and important for people to pay attention to it. ADAP, I mentioned. Post-exposure prophylaxis. I don't understand why gay men are not rioting in the streets demanding more information and access to post-exposure prophylaxis. Because the only reason that it has not been, people have not been educated about it and the access to it has not been made as available as it should be, is because of the concern that it's a disinhibitor. You know, it's a sort of moral filter on, oh, gay men are going to go out and do bad things. And just for your listeners who may not be aware of it, post-exposure prophylaxis, if a healthcare worker gets a needle stick, they're immediately put on a 28-day course of antiretroviral therapy, which is incredibly effective at preventing them from becoming positive. But if a condom breaks at 3 o'clock in the morning or someone does something that they regret quickly, how come they can't have access to that same emergency treatment to prevent them from becoming positive?
Right.
CDC has recommended it for some time, and in fact, you know, many hospitals, if you go through the emergency room and you're diligent enough and insistent enough, you may be able to get it, although in New York, some of them charge $1,500 or $1,600 for it. May require a 6 or 8 or 10 or 12-hour wait, and then you may or may not find somebody there who knows the protocol for it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, most gay men don't even know that such a thing exists.
Right.
And the problem is it has to be started within a day or two of the exposure, up to about 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 3 o'clock in the morning, you can't call your doctor
right.
And get a prescription. So there needs to be some other system, whether it's through emergency rooms or through a 24-hour hotline and delivery service or by, you know, dispensing 3-day starter kits or whatever so people can have them in their medicine chest or their DOP kit in case something happens. They can start it and buy themselves some time. right. until they can have the risk more accurately, you know, assessed. So I think there are issues that are going to become much more timely, and people are going to get more exercised about when they learn more about them.
I agree, and that post-exposure prophylaxis has been around for, what, 10, 12 years, longer than that. I mean, they've known about that, and it seems like it's just disappeared off the radar. You know, you never hear about it, and you're right. There are people that know that that something happened, but they're not going to go out and get that. Let's see, one more big question. You were in 1991. You were part of the ACT UP crowd that put a condom on Jesse Helms' home. I have a picture of that somewhere. I don't know. I've saved it on my file on my computer. I've always had a picture of the condom on Jesse Helms' home, and now I know who put it there. What was that? How did you get that to you? How did you get the condom?
Well, first of all, that was the first action for something called the Treatment Action Group, which was a group of ACT UP activists who were starting another effort just solely focused on treatment. And Helms had been such a such an enemy of people with AIDS and doing anything intelligent about the epidemic, that we really wanted to focus on him and ridicule him, you know, have people laughing at him. The idea was Peter Staley's, and the funding for the condom actually came, and I can reveal this because Peter has now talked about it finally, it was from David Geffen. Peter was on Fire Island with his then boyfriend Kevin Sessions, and there was, I think there's a backstory to it, but David came up to Peter on the beach one day and said, knew that Peter was trying to, you know, come up with the money to create this giant condom. It was made out of like a parachute material, and Geffen came up to him and I think gave him $3,000 or $3,500 to pay for it.
That's
and
great.
So we had the condom made with a, you know, big enough to fit over a two-story brick colonial home with a big reservoir tip on the top, and it said, "Protect yourself from unsafe politics. Jesse Helms is more dangerous than the virus." And there were seven of us, and we, you know, we had worked with somebody from Greenpeace to sort of take pictures of the house and do the measurements, and
right.
then practiced at Marvin Shulman. He was the ACT UP treasurer. He had a house up in Woodstock that was sort of a similar size, and so we timed people and practiced, you know, who was the fastest at getting the generators going or climbing up on the roof. And then that early that morning, we went to Jesse Helms' house. We were all in a U-Haul truck, and we had called the press, so the press was there. They didn't know what we were doing, but they just knew it was going to be newsworthy because of who was doing it. And we pulled up in front of the house and opened the truck up, and, you know, with the ladders, the generators. Peter and I were the two on the roof unrolling the thing and then inflating it with these generators, and you know, from the ground. And it was just about fully inflated. It was sort of more than semi-tumescent. It was like 80% tumescent when the police officer shows up. And it was a woman officer.
Oh, God.
And she may have been family. And she gets out of her squad car, like, laughing. And she said, "Oh, my God, I haven't even had my coffee yet." And then, you know, before you know it, a couple of hours, then the lieutenant, and they called Helms from there. They took all of our driver's licenses and so on, and we were kind of expecting to get charged. And Helms, one of the people heard it on the phone the cop was using, said he didn't want to give us any damn publicity. So we ended up not getting charged. Little did he know that we already had the camera crews there, and it was, you know.
Right.
But I actually think that
it was
quite effective because, you know, after that, Helms was never taken quite as seriously again on any AIDS stuff. He was much more marginalized into this kind of, you know, crazy, you know, weird social religious conservative voice. He didn't have the standing amongst his peers on this issue as he had before. That may have been happening anyway, but you know, having everybody kind of laugh at him a little bit and making
right.
a point in such a this way helped.
We only have 30 seconds. I want to thank you so much. This has been like, this like flew by in like 3 seconds, it feels like, but we've been on a half an hour, and I want to thank you for taking the time out of your schedule. I know that you are now running a hotel in Milford, Pennsylvania. Is that correct?
Well, I'm mostly working on HIV criminalization work and empowerment work, a new project around empowering people with HIV. But I am an investor in a boutique Relais Chateau hotel in Milford, Pennsylvania, called the Hotel Fauchere.
Fauchere.
For my plug.
Thank you very much. Good night.
Okay, thanks, Nathan. Bye.